Hey, it's Chris Jones with the Jones Zone, and this episode of the podcast is brought to you by the Jones Zone at Keller Williams Realty. That's right, we sponsor our own podcast. So if you know of anybody looking to buy, sell, rent, or invest in residential real estate in the Charlotte, Rock Hill, Fort Mill area, have them connect with us on their favorite platform. Enjoy the show.
It's Chris and Brian Jones, your real estate advocates, community connectors, talking Charlotte and York County area real estate and interviewing business owners, entrepreneurs, and community leaders. Welcome to the Jones Zone Podcast.
Do one, two, three this time instead of three, two, one.
All right, welcome to the Jones Zone Podcast. You know why I did the 1, 2, 3?
1, 2, 3, kid.
No, wrestling.
Okay. Well, my 1, 2, 3 kid was a wrestler, though. All right, so cool. I thought maybe that.
That's true. All right. Today, we are here with Jake Man Scout Manning. Jake is a professional wrestler. He's a stand-up comedian. He has a podcast of his own called How'd That Get Booked? How did this get booked?
Yes.
Which I am subscribed to. And he is also a video host. So, Jake, welcome to the Jones Zone.
Wow, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is where we're actually at Jake's house, so this is a first for us.
We're at my home studio.
Home studio.
I say, before you start describing what's around here and making everybody and downgrading like the idea of that, let's just say home studio.
We are on location.
Then just leave it there. It sounds far more professional than what's actually going on in here.
So. All right, so I gave a real brief watered-down introduction of you, but why don't you kind of give us your backstory and tell us how you got into everything that you're doing and your story, man.
Well, I mean, I think we were talking a little bit off mic, and I was like, well, you know, listen, let's get all the good stories on tape because I don't have that many good stories. But no, I grew up in a small town in Iowa, and I always was a big fan of professional wrestling.
Who's your favorite growing up?
Well, it's funny is, obviously Hulk Hogan was always the big deal, but like I've tried to research and find where my first match that I ever saw, because I have a vivid memory of, I believe it was Ted DiBiase or Terry Funk, but it was definitely versus Junkyard Dog. I remember seeing a VHS tape, and it's like one of my earlier memories in life. Like seeing Junkyard Dog come out and everybody stand up and get up, and it's like, I thought that was the coolest
thing. They
loved him. It was just how cool that was, and just always was hooked with professional wrestling with Hulk Hogan and everything like that. And then grew up, and then I got older, and I remember, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin was the big thing. Like I grew up in like the perfect age to be a pro wrestling fan, because I hit high school and got to be about 14, 15, right when the Attitude Era started to happen, where if I was like 3 or 4 years younger, my parents would tell me I'm not allowed to watch professional wrestling, which is kind of why there was a little bit of a lull in pro wrestling for a while. As I always refer to the younger brother generation, that wrestling became so sexualized and violent that a lot of young kids didn't get to see it. But I was already
That's an interesting theory there.
Yeah, but I was perfect, because at that moment in time, and by the time that people started realizing was violent, it's like, oh, he's already 16, 17, he's fine. So like,
I already watched Triple H and Shawn Michaels pull their pants down, so what's the point?
Exactly. Like, at that moment in time, it's like, well, he's already corrupted, it's fine. But like, that was like the perfect time, because it was Monday Night Wars, and it was just like the best time, and I grew up right alongside it, right as I wanted to see more of the stuff that WWE was putting out. I was getting older. When it was cartoony, I was a kid. And then as I started to evolve and change, so did pro wrestling. So I grew up in this perfect sweet spot of being a pro wrestling fan. And obviously Steve Austin was big. And I remember shaving my head right for the homecoming game my junior year. And I could grow a goatee as a junior in high school. So I looked like Stone Cold Steve Austin to kind of pump the football team up for the homecoming game.
You'd wear your jorts and just stumble out there?
Well, I definitely ran out. I think they played the glass break and everything. We ran on the field too. Like, it was real cool. And just, you know, all that. And then when I got introduced senior year, like, I did the Chris Jericho turn the back thing. So, like, it's one of the things, like, when you look back in life, like, there was all these little nuggets of things that I did and how I lived. Like, no wonder why he became a pro wrestler.
Are you going to say he's not a nugget? Is that what you're about to say?
No, I was going to say, there's a kid in our high school named what was his name? Gary. He worked with you at Food Lion. Gary.
Oh, yeah, Gary Pennington.
Pennington. They stood. They announced his name during the pep rally, and he stood up and did the DX.
Oh, he was crotch chopping right in the middle of the school pep rally. It was just like, what are you doing? Well, cool, man. So you're growing up in Iowa, you become a wrestling fanatic, and then just kind of, I mean, what'd you do after high school? What was the next kind of transition for you?
Well, the big thing for me was like, and as weird as it sounds, because it's so weird with the age of information and you can just Google wrestling schools, but it was like a different world back then. Like, you didn't know about wrestling schools. You didn't know they exist. Like, I was under the impression that the way you became a pro wrestler is you went to the University of Miami, you played football, Jim Ross came and saw you do the bench press a couple of times and arm drag a few people, and then you debut in Madison Square Garden as Rocky Maivia. Like, I figure that's how you became. So, like, my goal, because my family has a background, like, my uncle was a world record holder in the shot put. He was an Olympian.
Oh, okay. Dang.
He was a, you know, like, he kind of revolutionized the way people threw the shot, and he was a well-known shot putter. He just got inducted into the Track and Field Hall of Fame.
Oh, wow.
A few months ago. Like, he was a revolutionary
guy.
What's
his name?
Al Fuhrbach.
Okay.
If you look him up, like, he really kind of changed the game as far as shot putting goes. And of course, my dad was a decathlete, and my other uncle was also a world-class shot putter. So, like, obviously, I was like kind of like close enough to the youngest of my dad's family, so it was almost like I was like the youngest young, I was almost like another brother of extension of my dad's family.
Mm-hmm.
Because the, you know, my Uncle Steve, which was the youngest brother of my dad.
So we have an Uncle Steve.
Shout out Uncle Steve.
Uncle Steve was pretty far like down, like he was very late in my grandparents' life, but, and the space between him and the oldest was about the same amount of space that I was from Steve a little bit, so it kind of felt like I was like the sixth brother, you know, so like I was always competing against them trying to prove my worth. So then I got to do shot putting, and I just worked really hard at it. I didn't have a lot of natural ability for it. Like, I struggled a lot with it, but then as I got bigger, lifted weights, it just worked in my technique like insanely and became obsessed with it. I got good enough to get a track scholarship at a Division I university, and I went to Western Illinois, and my goal was to be an Olympian, so that way Jim Ross would come see me do the bench press and arm drag people, and I debuted as Rocky Maivia. So that's I was basically just doing my shot putting career just to get into pro wrestling, and then shot putting got very hard, and then I started to realize that there are pro wrestling schools, and maybe I should just go to a pro wrestling school, and I found one in Springfield, Illinois, and it was a very good place to start to kind of figure out if I wanted to do it. But if I really wanted my career to advance any further, I kind of needed more of a celebrity name or a name that carries a little bit of weight in professional wrestling. And I needed also to be on the East Coast because that's where all the shows were. I can drive to Philadelphia. I can drive to New Jersey. I can be in Florida, Knoxville, Tennessee. There's tons of shows in North Carolina, but I'm within a half an hour of wrestling anywhere. In anywhere from a half an hour to 9 hours, I've got a whole reach of places I can email, and I could be wrestling this weekend or the week after, just anywhere.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I wanted to get out here, and then that's when High Spots listed a 3-month internship that has now turned into a 12-plus-year residency.
And you've been wrestling on the side ever since, huh?
Well, the thing is High Spots is a pro wrestling merchandise company, so like part of the deal was they would give me wrestling training with George South. Who used to wrestle for Crockett Promotions WWF. He mostly is a job guy, but those are like the guys you want to learn from because they're the most versatile, they're the most knowledgeable, and also a lot of times they're the ones that are still around and willing to work with you like intensively.
Brooklyn Brawlers.
They're the guys that see this business far better. Like Brother Starr, sometimes they got pushed through certain levels of stuff,
gotcha.
Or they were caught a little bit, or for whatever reason they didn't understand why the things they were doing were working, or you know, because they'd have a booker telling them what to do, and this is how you get over, and they would just do it, but they wouldn't know why. Or someone like a George South ran his own shows, on top of wrestling himself, he's got a wealth of knowledge that he could just hand over to me. So that was part of the deal, was work for High Spots, go on the road, sell merchandise, set up the ring, they'd give you a match on the show, and it's kind of like have this young boy schedule, which even 12 years in, I kind of end up still working on. There's a lot of shows that come down here that setting up the ring, setting up the merchandise. Sometimes they want to film the show. I'm doing all that and wrestling on the show. First one in the building, last one out of the building. Still
long days.
Long days where, you know, everybody else is just rolling their bags and doing their match and then leaving. But
so which companies do you wrestle with or have you wrestled with? You're with PWX now, right?
PWX is a big one locally who I wrestle for. Big Time Wrestling when they come down here in the South. Northeast Wrestling, I go up there to Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, that area. A whole myriad of people in the North. I wrestle a lot in some southern companies, just some random ones here and there, whoever will come just have me or take me or whatever. I'm going to be going down to like Fest Wrestling in Florida. I'll also go down for Atlanta Wrestling Entertainment, you know, just to name off a couple. And also Wrestling Revolver is a big one, and they run out of Iowa, and that's where I was just at in the Midwest. So
you went down to Florida for WrestleMania, right? Show was that?
WrestleCon, and that's...
WrestleCon?
WrestleCon. My company has... jumped on the bandwagon maybe a little late, but early enough to start building our own little Comic-Con of professional wrestling, and we kind of piggyback off the fact of WrestleMania is going to have 100,000 wrestling fans there, and WWE can't service them all, so we run like a Comic-Con level event for professional wrestling, usually 2 days or whatever.
And
we were down there in Orlando this year. They're finalizing the details for New Orleans right now. We're going to be in two locations. We were in two locations this year and next year as well. So we'll have a hotel just specifically for wrestling shows and then one for autographs and pictures and stuff like that. So we'll be in two different places again. And
yeah. Well, keep us posted, man, because we want to go. I took my son to the one in Orlando.
Okay.
And it was awesome, man. So
just Mania, or did you go to WrestleCon by chance?
No, I just went. We went.
Should have went to WrestleCon. You would have met everybody.
Yeah.
Like there was like one day where we had like Shawn Michaels, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and X-Pac. They had a big Q&A.
How much is that to get in?
I think general admission's like $20. But then you can walk around and you have some of like Barbarian and Warlord. It's $20 to take a picture with them. So it's like an a la carte type of thing. So it's just $20 to walk in, but then you have vendors where you can buy tickets to go meet people. We'll have our own guests, and you can buy those tickets at the front. Like, we had the Hardy Boys literally right before they came back on WWE. So, like, you could walk in, or Ric Flair, you know. So, basically, you could show up and buy tickets to Ric Flair and get in this long line, meet Ric Flair, you know, and do all that, and then go around and pick up, like, the Godfather's autograph or Val Venus.
Actually, could you sign it as Papa Shango, please?
Yeah, or whoever, however. Like, it's just all kinds of... So you get to meet, like, all of them. And for a while, WWE was always, like, trying to avoid that, but then, as I see, they get guys that do the Hall of Fame, or guys that they bring in that are, you know, kind of... You know, working with them, it's a way for them to make an extra amount of money, because sometimes these promoters that'll bring them in for an autograph signing, it's like a couple thousand dollars. So if they kick us out, that's less money for the guys that are working for them, that company. Like Teddy Long, inducted in the Hall of Fame, and he was smart. The Hall of Fame happened on Friday. He was signing at our convention on Saturday. And originally it was supposed to be on Friday, but he moved it to Saturday, so that way you can take a picture with him in his Hall of Fame ring. Yeah. So, like, and
get your autograph of the WWE Hall of Famer Teddy Long.
And see, the thing is, and he's going to make thousands of dollars in it. And if you try and push someone like us out, Teddy's not going to make that big money.
Yeah.
And fresh off the Hall of Fame, he puts the ring on your finger. You hold it up. Like, that's a pretty rare opportunity that you're not really going to get, because access, those guys are going to sign for 2 hours and then just leave.
Yeah.
Where, like, at our place, they're there as however long they want to, and then they get to make their own money, manage their own money, and do their own thing.
See, I didn't know. I should have Googled stuff like that before I went down, because I was like, I'm not paying for access, because I heard it was just, like, crazy long lines and expensive.
And those guys are only there for 2 hours, so you might wait in line for, like, let's say you want to get Sheamus's autograph.
Two hours.
And you're waiting for... Exactly. And you could get right five away and, like, sorry. And
get lost. Yeah.
And then they slide in the Miz. And you're like, oh, God.
I
don't
like that, actually.
And then that's what happens. But where, like, if you get in a line for Ric Flair and he's contracted this time, or he'll do it with, like, hey, I'll stay for another hour, we'll work it out and usually get what you paid for. So, if you pay attention to the times. If you're like, I'll just walk over there, whatever. You know?
So your gimmick is a man scout, like as in a man Boy Scout, right?
Cub Scout, Boy Scout, Man Scout.
Cub Sorry. Scout, Boy Scout, Man Scout. Okay, how'd you come up with that? Is that...
That was what I originally wanted to do, like when I started in Springfield. Like that was the idea. Like it's just like, oh, you need a character, you need to stand out. Like, because that's the fun of it. Yeah. That's the fun of pro wrestling. Like, what am I going to be?
Yeah.
Because I grew up, you know, like even like when I first, you know, when I... was got cable and you're seeing the TL Hoppers and the Bob Hollies and Jean-Pierre Lafitte, like everybody was kind of a something, and people like rip on that time of wrestling, but no, that's how you stand out. That's the fun. Like I've always saw in the characters, that's what I wanted, was to be a character. And I was an Eagle Scout and I had all my Eagle Scout stuff, and I was like, man, the Boy Scout, man, that makes a lot of sense, and that'd be real good. And that was always my idea. And so, like, I remember pitching it to the people I started with, and they're like, nope, that's a dumb idea. You're gonna be a Mr. Perfect knockoff, and you're gonna be called Mr. Elite. And I didn't even have a real name for a while. I was just Mr. Elite for like a year and a half, and then finally I came up with my own name, Jake Banning, and I kind of wrestled around a little bit, and I'm like, and I'm gonna try this Boy Scout thing like on a fair show. And then like the first 5 minutes of the match before I ever locked up, the guy I wrestled looked right at me and was like, this is the best thing you've ever done.
And, were you a baby face or?
No, I was a bad guy. Because it was, you gotta keep in mind, you gotta think about Kurt Angle. What made him work is he was all American and people hate that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that, like, that's why I always knew my niche would be.
You're the over, you're the goody two shoe kind of.
Because nobody likes that.
I saw you doing like this.
Nobody likes that at all. Everybody hates that. Like, my favorite X-Men is Cyclops. Yeah. And everybody calls him like, ah, shut up, Boy Scout. And like Cyclops, I think, is the best X-Men of all time because, you know, he's the leader. He's trying to get everybody like, hey, guys, at the beginning of like every like cartoon or comic book, like, guys, we need to work together and we'll defeat whoever we'll defeat. And everybody's like, ah, screw you, Scott. Screw you, Boy Scout. And then everybody does their own thing. They get in trouble and something happens and they get, and it looks like they're going to lose. And all of a sudden they team together and they beat the Sentinels or Magneto, whatever they're gonna do, and they beat them as a team. And then afterwards they're like, good call, Logan, on like telling everybody to work together. Like, yeah, really work together. Well, meanwhile Cyclops is like, motherfuckers, I told you from the get-go, like, just work together.
Wolverine gets all the credit.
Yeah, like, you pat Wolverine in the back, I'm the one telling you.
Sitting over there like,
and then like Logan's like hitting on his girlfriend. It's like, Jesus, man. Like, so like I've always saw, like, you know, that type of idea, like, what if, like, and then you look at the now version of, you know, Cyclops, he's much darker.
Yeah.
And I always saw the opportunities of the Man Scout and the evolution of that character. What if he's just said, nah, screw it, I'm gonna do my own thing, like that darkness to that character.
Yeah, and that's kind of how we think about The Rock came, because he was the good Rocky Maivia.
Yeah, he was like a Samoan.
Rocky Maivia, he's all happy, and the fans just hated it, though.
Yeah, because, and that's the thing, too, is, like, that's what I grew up with, is people just dumping on the guy that was the goody-two-shoe good guy. Right. So, instead of going through all the pains of people hating you, like, well, I don't know why they hate me, he's like, no, I want them to hate me because of this, and just jumping right to that.
Yeah. How do you think Cena reacts to that? Because he still has his, like, legit fans that pull for him, but then he's also got the heat, too.
He's got to revel in it. Because here's the thing, and this is what I've noticed every time I've seen WWE live, and like I would watch, like I think it was SummerSlam in 08 or 07, which was very much a down period of the thing in wrestling.
Yeah, those were rough years.
And then also too, like now, I saw, it wasn't too long ago, like it was like at Raw or something like that, and then a couple years ago at the same time, he always gets the biggest reaction. Now, not all of it's cheers. Some of that's booze. Some of that is, you know, cheers. Some of it's a mixture. But here's the thing. Everybody gets up and reacts when he comes out.
Yeah.
That's the remarkable thing.
Right.
Like, I was there when him and CM Punk wrestled at the Allstate Arena when Punk won and then walked out. Mm-hmm. Like, the reaction he was getting as a heel was better than what I've seen anybody get as a babyface. So as a pro wrestler, you want just a general reaction, because when they're not doing anything, that's the most harmful.
That's gotta be the worst.
Like, I was just at a show this weekend, and like nobody cared, nobody got pro wrestling, and also it was like in the Midwest, so everybody's being overly polite. So like when somebody yelled, they're like, ah, screw you, a polite Midwest person, like, hey, don't yell, be quiet. and I would start to yell at the person that was shushing that person.
Don't you shush him?
Let him yell at me. I'm the bad guy, because that's what we want. So I think when he walks out there and he gets that much energy. That's what he looks for. He doesn't care if it's good or bad. He just wants those people to put that much energy in him. And that's, you talk to any artist or performer and stuff like that, they're like, I really don't, you know, care. I just want you to feel something about this particular thing. If this makes you mad, if this makes you happy, makes you sad, whatever it is. I think he looks at it so much like that, is that, hey, I want them to react.
So in respect to that, how do you juxtapose your life as a wrestler and your life as a comedian? I mean, you obviously have some sort of, not addiction per se, as in a negative light.
No, but I do. I have a problem.
Love that reaction.
I have a problem.
So, how do you manage both? And then what led you to get into stand-up comedy, you know?
Well, it's funny that you say addiction a problem. It's something that I was thinking about yesterday, because I had just gotten off the road like yesterday. I hadn't seen my girlfriend in like a week, and I was like unloading the van at work with all the equipment, and I'm like, hey, I'm gonna head down to the Muse. I got just enough time to get changed and go there, and I'll see you later on tonight at 10. Like, and I just, it was like 6, and then I just had to take a step, and I go, what are you doing? Because like, I basically had a wrestling, before I left, I had a wrestling show on Sunday. I did the Evening Muse open mic Monday. I was at the Comedy Zone that Tuesday. Then Wednesday, I was at wrestled at Rockstar Pro. I did open mics in Chicago on Thursday. I did an open mic in Rock Island on Friday. Did the Revolver show on Saturday. Tried to do an open mic in Chicago on Sunday. I was waiting around for it, but didn't happen because it was holiday weekend. And then here I am trying to go back again. And it's just like, and even before that, Sunday, I actually had a wrestling show that Saturday. So here it was. I've gone through 8 days of performing, being on the road, and here I am, person I love, I tell you, I gotta wait a minute because I want to get on, I got on a stage. And I was like, okay, I think you could, like, it's, and it's obviously a holiday, I'm allowed to, like, nobody's probably gonna be there, it's not gonna be as good as it normally is, just go home. And yeah, I had to take that situation of like, it's gonna be okay. But there's still that panic in me right now, because I didn't go up on stage on Sunday, I didn't go up on stage last night, so now there's this panic of me going up tonight at a mic, and I'm just like, oh, I have to do it tonight or else I feel awful. And then I just rescheduled training, and I forgot that there's a new Wednesday mic that I can do and get to perform. Like, oh gosh, why'd I reschedule training? Like now I won't be able to get get up on stage 4 times. Even though I'm running my own show Thursday, I got to record my own podcast on Friday, I got a wrestling show on Saturday, I got another comedy show here in Charlotte on Sunday, and then back through the week again, and then take off of the road for 2 shows in Connecticut. It's still not enough. And it's like one of those things, I have to come to a conclusion that I will never be happy. And then, but I do this because I like performing. I like making people laugh. And that's the thing. It's like I came to this realization like last week, as I was looking at my calendar, I was like, I have a serious problem, and that I don't know if I'll ever be happy. Because if I had the week off and I scroll through Instagram and I see somebody at a show, I'm gonna be like, why am I not doing that show? So I'm never gonna be happy. Yeah. Even if I take a break and relax, I'm gonna see somebody else doing something. Mm-hmm. Even though I wouldn't, like, the likelihood of me doing that show is impossible, or, you know, or I'm not getting booked, or I know I would never get booked on that show, or this person's recording a special and I'm obviously not ready there to do that comedy wise but it's just like, I look at other people doing things and I can't handle it, because I want to perform, I want to be one in the front, you know. But that just goes to show, even if I did get successful and even if I did get that spot, I'd still never be happy. So I think the fact that I have recognize that within myself, that I will never be happy, then it's one of those things you can kind of, like, once you know what the problem is, you can deal with it. That's kind of how I've had to deal with it myself, is knowing that, you know, I'm always going to want to do more. So let's just schedule as much shit as possible. Try and find a way to do it. If you get crazy and you just have to take a step away, then you take that step away. Like, I think a couple Fridays ago, it was running pretty ragged like that, and I didn't have anything on a Friday, and it's got to a point, like, Wednesday, I'm like, no, on Friday, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get on my bicycle, I'm going to go, I'm going to get drunk, and I'm going to do, and I'm not going to think about anything. And I'm just going to get on my bicycle, hopefully don't get a DUI on my bicycle, and just kind of chill and not think about anything, not think about being funny, not think about, do I look good enough in spandex, to think about, are my moves working well, what are people going to do, are people going to make a gift file list, not have to worry about any of it. And just make it, just worry about myself for a day. Or and then like I think later on that night I took my girlfriend out to eat. Like just worry about being present with her in this moment. Where if I had a couple of days off before then, or I'd kind of been off for a thing, my mind would wander to something else. My idea is just to book myself to oblivion, so that when I take my breaks, I want to take those breaks.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of how I'm going to start attacking my life in the next couple of months. And looking at my calendar, that's most certainly what I'm doing.
Did you have any trouble getting on stage at first? Yeah, like stage fright.
The first time I did stand up, it was awful. Like it was horrendous, and there's still moments where I just it's still rough. Like I'll still have one where it's like, oh god, you know, I'll have awful. I had a set a couple weeks ago, and I was like just doubting my life. I'm like, I don't know if I'll ever be funny again. And then it messed me up the next day. And there's like three in a row where I just bombed hard. I'm like, I don't know if I'll ever be funny ever again. And like it rubbed me so raw that like that next time after those three, I was just like, I don't know, I'll just try. And it just getting a couple laughs and kind of getting momentum, and it was an okay set, but it was like, I saved my life. You know what I'm saying? Like it was like this panic, and I pulled myself out of it. It was like another week yet before I felt like I was kind of getting back to the comic I felt like I was before, which isn't all that great, but like it felt like I was like degressing.
Yeah, helpless.
Yeah, so I felt like I was in a tailspin, but like I felt like okay, you're back to at least where you were before, so you're at least gonna take steps here. But there was just that panic of like, I don't know if I'll be funny again.
Stand-up comedy is really hard. Yeah. It's I don't think people understand how hard it is. I tried it. I was awful. I couldn't do it, man. And it would make me feel really anxious. So very first time I did it, I was in college, and I was up there, and I thought I was doing okay, but somebody yelled, "Wrap it up." And I literally said, "Okay." And then I put the mic in and basically snuck out through the back around some dumpsters and just went home. And then I tried it a few months later at a different place, actually the Comedy Zone here. This was probably in 03 or so, 04. And did okay. And then did it again and did all right. But then I went to this open mic at
what was it?
SK Net Cafe.
Yeah, were you here? Crown Station. Not when it was SK Net, but Crown Station is what it became. And then that's where I did my first mic. And now I think it's going to be torn down or whatever.
Oh, really?
But yeah.
I had such a miserable experience that night that it pretty much, like I was just like, forget it, man. I went in and I did my set. Well, here's the thing. I signed up, and I guess I got put at the very bottom just because the regulars, I guess, got put ahead of me or whatever. So I was there. I felt like I was waiting there forever and ever. It just kept getting later and later. And, like, honestly, by the time I got up there, I didn't even really want to do it anymore. I just wanted to go home. So I did it, and then I walked out, and somebody was like, "Yeah, I knew he'd leave as soon as he was done." And I was just like, well, I'm not coming back. I couldn't remember.
So it was almost like the dentist's office. Like, you know, you get there, and you're expecting to go when they call your name, and then people are just coming in from outside and just getting to see the dentist. And like, hey, I was here before him.
Yeah, yeah, it was
so brutal. That went on for like 3 hours.
It was. Were you there?
Yeah, I was there.
With Sean and Amanda? Yeah. It was. I remember Sean and Amanda being there, but I was just like, man, I don't know. And it just made me. I would get so anxious and stuff. I never worked through it. I just gave up, I guess. But
yeah, sometimes that happens. Like I could go to like sign up at Chicago or whatever, and it's just like a random. Like I don't know the host, because sometimes if you know the host, you're like, oh, I'll give you a good spot.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it just is how it is. Like also in Chicago too is like whoever showed up to the building there first. Like, you have to keep an eye on, like, who else walked in. You don't want to be, like, you walk in, like, yeah, sure, sign up. You got there 20 minutes before sign up, but somebody was there half an hour ahead of you. So you want to, like, the thing is, like, hey, who got here before you? Kind of regulate that way. And then sometimes I still move you around a little bit. And that is what it is. But that's one of the things, like, I think of a tweet or an Instagram post by Mike Lawrence. He said one time is that, if you can't handle being pushed to the end of an open mic, what do you think the rest of entertainment's going to do to you?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of something I always remember when something like that usually happens, or something doesn't go my way, or it doesn't go quite right, or it's like, you know, one of those things that happen. That's the thing that I always remember. It's like, well, I've got big things that I want to do.
Yeah.
And when those big things happen, how am I going to handle it? If I can handle this, I'm not going to handle that situation any better. And that's kind of how I've tried to look at those situations. And also, too, that helps because, like, that rings true for me with pro wrestling. Like, I've already got a career where I did those things. And yeah, sure, it didn't pan out quite as well as I wanted to, but I know people that have gone through those examples, and that rang true. So, like, I have this whole career of performing and politics, and this person got this because of this, and the only reason that person's there is because of that, and all those things that come with it are like, oh, they're only booking these type of people, or they only want that, and I'm not this, but then when I got there, they didn't care, and then, or I pissed this guy off. Like, I have a whole career where that has happened already with me, and now I'm in another pool where similar stuff like that happens. I'm able to already zoom out, assess with this situation, like, oh, this is like that. I mean, this isn't going to hinder what this other thing I want to do, or this other thing I want to do, because I already went through it over here in this other pool. So I can kind of zoom out, deal with it, reassess, I'm like, this isn't a big deal. Just go through it, grit your teeth, it'll be fine. It's going to come out okay. And just do what you do. You
know? Yeah. I think if I was older, I would have had a better perspective. But yeah. At that time, I was just like, I just want to get out of here.
Exactly. And that's the thing is, in pro wrestling, I did the same thing when I was young. And I did probably the same thing you did, but a pro wrestling equivalent of that.
Yeah.
And so, but somehow I kept with it. But that's the thing, when you're young, you go through that. And you think, I was just thinking about this on the drive. Like, when you're young, you think that, you know, that puddle that gets thrown in, that rock that gets thrown in your puddle of your dreams, you think it's the worst thing ever, and that those ripples that get pushed away from that rock that got put in your little puddle, those ripples are going to be just this negative effect that happens, and it just happens to the rest of your life. But then come to find out that rock creates ripples that are actually positive and lead you in a direction and point you in a direction that you will leads you to success, or leads you to something positive, or create something wonderful and great that you wouldn't have if nobody would have walked up and thrown a rock into your puddle. And sometimes those ripple effects are sometimes the best thing for you. Sometimes it's like, yeah, sure, something bad happened to you, but then you're like, well, I'm never going to go here, I'll go over here. Or something bad happened to you and somebody saw it. Like, hey, man, that was real messed up. We're going to be best friends now. You know what I'm saying? Like, whatever it is. Sometimes that negative thing results in good things, and I'm old enough to know that right now, but when I was 22, I did not know that at all. So
other than your being able to build up your sense of resilience, how has your career as a wrestler helped your career as a comedian? I mean, or do you take material from both worlds, or how does that work?
Well, I feel I can't say that pro wrestling makes me necessarily like the best comedian. I'm comfortable, at least in front of people. I've always been very competitive, so sometimes there's a sense of like, if there's other comedians on the show, I want to show them, like, oh, I'm gonna be the guy that, I'm gonna come in with some attitude. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's that mental state that because before, I'm actually very much an introvert, you know. But I have this gear inside of me that I'm kind of locked in right now because we're recording and there's a microphone and there's a little thing recording our wave levels right now. So I hypnotized myself right before I went out in my first wrestling event because I was so introverted, and I was like, I was a young kid that I couldn't even order food over the phone.
Oh man,
I was so scared to even do that. I couldn't even order food in a restaurant. I was so shy, and it was crippling, it was debilitating. Just forget about asking girls, and forget making new friends.
Yeah,
you know, so it was very difficult for me that way. But like, right before I went out to do my first ever pro wrestling match, I had to self-hypnotize myself into saying that, hey, these people paid to see you do something. Whether it's go out there and vomit all over the ring.
He's gonna puke!
Or do a moonsault, or whatever it is. They paid to see you do something. So you just gotta go out there and do something.
Yeah.
You can't freeze, because you freezing, that they not get their money's worth. So my idea of giving people their money's worth is how I self-hypnotize myself. And then ever since then, when it's like I walk out from the curtain, or I walk out from the dark, or I walk up to the microphone, I get that mentality inside of my head. These people pay money, or these people are here, they expect to see a show, and I become a different person. You know what I'm saying? When this person presses record, they expect me to be on point. They expect to give some stories. So it's just like I lock into this weird zone of just performing. Like, they deserve something. You know, you might not be able to get all the words right, but you gotta do so. You gotta keep talking. You gotta keep moving. You gotta keep bumping. You gotta do whatever. So it's like I self-hypnotize myself into doing that. And that's how I overcame that. So
Once you started comedy, did the wrestling promoters or writers bring you in to help with the night's plans, I guess?
It's something I get more promo work, just because I feel like, I don't know if necessarily like pro wrestling helps. Like I said, I think the thing that I get, you know, I'm more, a little more outgoing on stage, so I have somewhat of a personality. That's what helps comedy, but I don't think it's quantified large amount of success. But I do feel that doing stand-up, like I'm on a live microphone anywhere from 3 to 5 times a week, for sure, every week. At least 3 times, as much as 5, sometimes 6 or 7, depends. That has made me a better guy on the microphone in pro wrestling. I feel untouchable. Like if I'm in a wrestling ring and I have a microphone, I actually think I'm better on the microphone. Like if I did a stand-up set in a wrestling ring, I'd probably kill it and destroy
it. Best of both worlds, right?
But just because, like, that just being in that ring, I've been in there.
You know, Dolph Ziggler does stand-up.
Yeah. Well, he's in a tough spot, too, because he's so famous. And yeah, he can get spots, but the problem is he's so good at something else, they're going to expect him to be just as good at comedy right away. Well, that's usually not the case. It's going to be a couple years before he gets to that level that he's going to be just as good as he is for wrestling. And the thing is, too, he's such a out there personality that, you know, he can't just do open mics. If he goes to an open mic, someone's like, oh, Dolph Ziggler's here. And if he works on something and he doesn't go well, which ultimately it won't.
Yeah.
People are going to say, look, I saw Dolph Ziggler at a mic. He sucks. He was awful. And then he's got this branding of like, he's not good. Yeah. And all it takes for one asshole on Twitter to retweet it, because he's just famous enough that the people would recognize him and say it and want to shit on him for it. So he's not going to get that time to mature and have that process. I mean, he could write some good stuff, but you need to work on it. And that's, he can't hide within it. Where you're like, you need that time to suck with anything. When you're in a band, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with having that time to just suck.
Yeah.
You know, like, we live in this world.
You gotta hone your craft.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. We live in a world of American Idol where people are like, they just think, oh, I go on this TV show and then I become famous. And that's, they don't get the fun part of me and my friends. We started a band in a garage. We toured for 10 years. I got better as a guitar player. And then finally we got a break. I was good. And that's when we exploded, and that's when we became Pearl Jam or whatever else, as we'd already been playing for 10 years, and we just knew, and we were ready, and everything clicked, and it happened. We're going to miss out on that. And that's the nice thing with me, is I'm just not famous enough that I can sign up an open mic and nobody has any clue who I am. Nobody has any idea, but I can say I'm a pro wrestler and they think it's cool. And they're like, oh, that's great, he's a pro wrestler. And we'll sit down and do a podcast with him. And there's that coolness to it. And then also, too, I'm just respected enough and just enough of a presence in pro wrestling that when you do look me up, like I said, you guys see, oh, he wrestled Kevin Owens. Oh, he's wrestled Joey Ryan. And you're like, oh, he's actually done some things. He's a champion. He's been around for a bit. So he's kind of a guy, because I know a couple of comedians that used to be pro wrestlers that they were so bad that they don't even let people know what the wrestling names were.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, there's a couple guys that did it. I don't want to call them out because I don't want to call out how bad they were at pro wrestling or whatever. But, like, they were guys that, like, they did it and they weren't great at pro wrestling. So, like, they don't want people to know that they were a guy. So it's like, oh, like,
probably talking about Mick Foley.
Hardly. But then there is those guys like Mick Foley, like, you expect them to be just as good, so they can't really do open mics and hone their craft. So I'm in this wonderful sweet spot that I'm just enough of a guy that we'd look me up and like, oh, this guy's a deal. But then at the same time, too, I'm just under famous enough or unknown enough that I can go up, sign up an open mic, bomb really hard, and it doesn't hurt my credibility anywhere. I've got this. I don't even know if Cole Cabana has that much flexibility in who he is. Where I have this weird flexibility. Like, luckily, I never got famous as a pro wrestler, so like that helped. Finally, me not being as over as everybody else has finally helped me in something.
It's so, fun, huh?
Yeah, it's like finally being the Rodney Dangerfield of professional wrestling or Mark Maron of pro wrestling finally worked out in my favor. So
I thought you said Mark Marrow at first. I was like, yeah, he did pretty good for himself.
Mark Maron, Mark Marrow, just combining together, you get me.
So Mark Maron has a good podcast. What got you into podcasting and your YouTube channel, and what made you want to start all that?
Well, because I was like, I've always been a person that's like, I want to do that, so let's go do it. You know what I'm saying?
Audible.
Yeah, I just was like, I just saw, I've always been that type of person, like, I want to go do that. Like, pro wrestling, I'm like, oh, I want to go do that. Stand up, I want to go do that. And, like, I got really into podcasting, I'm like, I want to do that. And I knew some people that were doing it, and I asked a few questions, and I just went up and did it. And as shitty as this sounds, I have this attitude that I can just do anything. Yeah. And as shitty as it sounds, I'm like, you know, I'm a 30-year-old white male, Christian, straight, a good credit. What's gonna the fuck's gonna stop me? There are people that have far more obstacles.
That's what this country's all about.
I have no obstacles, so there's nothing that you fucking stand in the way of anything. Like my girlfriend, my girlfriend's African American. I think she even said that to me one time. She's like, "What the fuck's gonna stop you from doing anything? Right. You know, other than what stupidity you have in your head." So, like, if I want to do something, go out and do it. You know what I'm saying? I'm very fortunate that I've took care of my money. I'm very fortunate, and everything else in my life that I have the ability to go try and do all these things. So let's go do it. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not handicapped. You know, I'm not. You know, like, that was the thing with pro wrestling. Like, I had to be like, oh, I'm glad I didn't grow up and I have full use of my legs and full use of my limbs.
Yeah.
You know, comedy. Thank God I'm not deaf. How awful that would be. You write these wonderful jokes and you don't hear the laugh. Like, you know what I'm saying? And you don't have that gauge, you know? And that's the thing. It's like, I have all the abilities to me, and podcasting is one of those things. Like, what's stopping me? You work in video editing? How hard is it going to be in the audio? Like, obviously, all this equipment set up, like, it kind of intimidated me at first, but hey, I was like, I'll figure it out.
And, you know, if this was in front of me, I would probably just know, like, 4 or 5 dials and buttons,
which is the audio board, which you're pointing at right now.
Yeah, the audio board, and then the rest will go unused. I would learn just enough to get by.
I don't know how you feel about name dropping, but you've mentioned a couple names already, Kevin Owens and Colt Cabana. But who are some of the other guys that you've worked with and that you've had good experiences with in the wrestling world?
Well, to work in a little plug about myself, I actually just released a 6-disc DVD set that's also available on digital download as well. It was called Jake Manning's The Man Scout's Guide. I'm gonna mess it up. Why did I pick the longest name? The Man Scout's Guide to Surviving a Night Under the Stars, which is basically 60 plus wrestling superstars and myself on this video collection. And it was just basically a list of all of anybody that was a name who I wrestled, who I lost to, is basically who I put on this thing. And it just was like, it's got Gold Dust, it's got Bobby Eaton.
Where can I get this?
You can get it at DIY Wrestling, or you can also get the DVD version on my website, howdidthisgetbooked.com/merch. It's available there, but you can get a digital download on DIY Wrestling at DIYWrestling.com. Just search Man Scout, it'll pop up.
Bobby Eaton, Gold Dust, who else?
But I think the big one that I always say when we talk about name dropping, I wrestled in a match versus Jerry the King Lawler. Me and Jerry have wrestled multiple times. We've wrestled each other almost a dozen times in like 7 different states. But this match that's on the DVD set or in the video collection is me versus Jerry Lawler. In his corner, he had Mick Foley. In my corner, I had Terry Funk. I'm still amazed that I ever existed in that airspace. And Terry Funk said my name and he stood side by side with me. He even slapped me around a little bit. Like, one of the greatest moments of my entire career ever. Cool. And a lot of the stuff that I wrestled with Northeast Wrestling, a lot of guys like that. I just had a really good match with Ryback recently. So
what's he doing?
He's on the indies, man. He's killing it. He's doing a great job, you know, being very opinionated on his podcast.
But
you know, like, he was good. He knew my stuff, man. Like, he was well worth the money that the promoter paid and who ended up wrestling me that night. And he made me look like $1 million, man.
That's awesome.
So,
who is your dream opponent?
I still have not wrestled the Fallen Angel, Christopher Daniels. And it's very personal to me. I took a seminar with him when I first started in like 03, 04. And he gave me some advice that was kind of the template for my entire career. And I would just love to have just one little match with him. It could just be a little squash match on TV for Ring of Honor. Like, it doesn't have to be like an, like on a big show for 20 minutes. It could be the smallest, simplest little 10-minute match. Just me doing a couple things to him, and then he hit me with some of his stuff, and then we just get out of there and leave. It doesn't have to be fantastic. Just the sharing the ring with him would mean so much to me, because he gave me some nuggets of knowledge that basically put me on the path to maybe not the most successful career, but put me on the path to have a place in wrestling and have some credibility of who I am and be knowledgeable and kind of my place in wrestling. That's one. And then the other one, unfortunately, will definitely never happen. It was Brad Armstrong. Mm. Like, Brad Armstrong was like a big influence on me as a young man.
And the Armstrong family's huge in wrestling, aren't they?
Yeah. And, well, the thing, and I've wrestled, you know, I wrestled against Road Dogg a couple of times. Did you? Like the New Age Outlaws. Yeah. Like, did a tag match with them a couple of times. And then, but like, Brad Armstrong, it was Brad Armstrong, Arn Anderson, and Bobby Eaton, WCW Saturday Night in 1995. Like, those were always my three favorites to see. And Saturday Night. Remember that, Chris? And I never knew anything about like them, their reputations prior. It was just what I saw in 1995. And Bobby's a blue blood, mm-hmm. and you know, Brad Armstrong is basically relegated to making other guys look good. Mm-hmm. Arn Anderson's kind of being pushed in that thing, so he had to make the Renegade look good, and he would sometimes
Ultimate
be
Warrior knockoff.
But of course, he would be the main event on that show, you know. But at the same time, too, it's like, this is WCW Saturday Night '95, being mm-hmm. the main event on that show. You're not necessarily the main event on the pay per view and stuff like that, but he's still so good. And like, those are my three guys when I was like, those are guys I want to be like. And I've gotten to wrestle Bobby Eaton, obviously. I've had a couple moments with Arn where he's seen me wrestle, like at like tryouts, like before like they open up the doors of WWE. But Brad Armstrong was always the one that I want to have just one match with him, and it just never got done. It was close. It was booked. It was going to happen, but then he got hired by WWE, and then he came back, and then it never matriculated. And that was all. That's like the saddest part, is I never got to do that. And George South, my trainer, he would always call me Bullet, because when I had hair, I looked like a member of the Armstrong family. I looked like Brad Armstrong. So like, he was always a big influence on me. He was my favorite.
What's kind of the closest that you got to the WWE? Or
I've done a dark match, so I felt okay, I've been in their ring before. Like, that was a big thing. Like, I've wrestled in your ring before, which, nice. I mean, thousands of guys have done it, but, like, it's one of those things, like, okay, well, I feel like I can call myself a wrestler now, you know?
Yeah.
I did, like, a dark match with Alex Riley in Raleigh, mm. North Carolina, I think in 2009. Like, that's as close as ever comes. But, like, when I was ready to be up there is when they had zero interest in indie guys. Like, almost to the point, like, you came in for extra talent work, you weren't allowed to eat catering. That was a rumor, but like, you could, but like, that was a rumor going around when I was doing it. Like, oh, somebody fucked up, and now extra talent can't eat catering now.
Dude, he's just sitting there eating catering.
There was times where like, our locker room would be a tent, and they'd post the sign extra talent, and they'd have a tent right there. I'm like, all right, set up your locker room, and like, they wouldn't even get somebody to work there to set up this little canopy that didn't even have any sides to it. And that was like, this thing, they just put like a little top, but there's no sides. And like, that's where you're training. Like, whoa, what, you think it's gonna rain in the middle of the Norfolk Coliseum? Like, get out of here. Like, it was just like weird stuff like that. Like, they were so dismissive of us even existing there.
Randy Orton's got a beef with indie guys. It's all over Twitter. Like,
he was all right. He just, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, you gotta shake everybody's hand, but then if you do shake people's hand, like, oh, what are you shaking my hand for? Like, they're gonna be a hard time, but like, if you don't shake everybody's hand, it's like, you gotta play that whole rigmarole all day long.
He had problems with Bubba Ray Dudley or something, right?
Yeah.
Well, that whole situation that you're talking about came from people, Rip Rogers posting something on Twitter about like, indie guy matches looking all the same, which, you know, he makes a good point, but Rip Rogers has always been that type of guy, you know, and that's fine. But, you know, Rip's more asking, he's not so much dumping on the way that people wrestle and people doing a lot of stuff. He's dumping on the fact that it looks the same.
Gotcha.
You know what I'm saying? And it's repetitive. Rip's always been a guy, think outside the box, think outside the box. Think differently. That's been his biggest beef. And now he's seeing that everybody, all these indie guys doing a lot of matches, and sometimes they are a little bit the same, or especially guys that don't know what they're doing, or definitely guys that are trying to emulate those guys. Mm-hmm. Seeing that's rough to see. And I think that's the point he was trying to make, and that a lot of people attacked Rip. And of course, Randy saw it, and he's like, I'm going to stick up for my trainer. Mm. And I think that's a lot. And then, of course, the way he put some things is a little bit of him being out of touch with indie guys as well. Like, talking about, like, all these people, it was a sellout crowd, we made all this money. Yeah, but WWE is what sold out, not Randy Orton's name was. Like, and it's one of those things that just understanding, you know, where you're at. And he's never traveled down the road that Kevin Owens has traveled down and had that many doors slammed into his face and stuff like that. But really, at the end of the day, he was sticking up for his trainer. So it's a weird situation like that. So I can't. Nobody's to blame. Nobody's the hero.
All right, man. We're coming up on 50 minutes. I want to thank you for all your time. Why don't you tell everybody how they can see your comedy and see your wrestling and get in touch with you.
Best way is I am available on Twitter and Instagram at ManScoutManning. You can log on to my website, howdidthisgetbooked.com. That's where I have my merch and I have everything about my podcast. Also, look me up on YouTube, just ManScoutManning. I need as many subscribers as I possibly can for that. I have clips of my comedy, clips of full matches of mine. That's also like I post my podcast on there. So those are probably the best way to get in touch with me. Also, to highspots.com, which is my employer. So if you keep them in business, that keeps me traveling down this road of being a gypsy for the rest of my life.
All right, man. Jake, ManScout Manning, thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure, pleasure.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.
I'm going to get you in the DDT before I leave here.
Thanks so much for listening to the Jones Zone Podcast with Chris and Brian Jones. We'll catch you on the next episode.